This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We decided there was a lot of fruit and vegetables that were sitting in the market and that were going to no use and was being disposed of. And we then came up with the idea of let's go out and rescue this produce and let's get around to our kitchens, our hotels, our restaurants, and let's see how many people we could reach.
That was Yejna Maharaj, a member of Chefs with Compassion, a group of cooks using salvaged food to feed thousands of South Africans left hungry as a result of COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, the new U.S. Biden administration could face a new challenge in Africa, where democracy seems to be backsliding. And Guinea worm disease has now been nearly eradicated in Africa. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As President Joe Biden stressed that democracy and human rights will be core value in U.S. foreign policy, African presidents reacted differently. Some are introducing cosmetic steps to show they are reforming, while others are concerned they may be pressured to take real steps towards those principles. Some experts believe that regular summits with African leaders, such as the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit of 2014, offer an opportunity to focus on many common priorities. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi how the Biden administration would face a new challenge in Africa where democracy is backsliding.
Regular meetings with African leaders could provide an opportunity to reinforce these principles of democracy, human rights, and good government. However, as we've seen, commitment to democracy is very mixed by African leaders. And so just talking about these issues will be insufficient. You know, they're going to have to be backed up by actions that differentiate countries based on their commitment to democracy. And so rather than just holding summits with all African leaders, it'll be interesting to see if, as a follow-up to the democracy summit, the Biden administration gives emphasis to meetings with democratically oriented leaders on the continent. And that way they would send the message that legitimacy matters. And countries where leaders have been fairly elected and they govern democratically, they're going to have more opportunities to benefit from U.S. engagement and investment and development support.
But would African countries take into consideration Biden's focus on democracy and the human rights?
I think we're going to see a variance on that. Again, there's 54 African countries and the whole spectrum in terms of their government types. And some are going to be more receptive, some are going to be less receptive. But I think what we're seeing, and we've seen over the last number of years, that a strong voice from the United States and international actors in support of democracy and human rights and better governance makes a big difference in trying to advance these norms. And it helps to strengthen democratic actors on the continent who are also striving for these same goals. You know, we really have seen that a strong message from the U.S. makes a difference. And these governments are watching. And this backsliding we've seen over the last several years, it's because these leaders realize there's no cost and they can lower the bar as low as they want. And they're still getting recognized. There's no reputational cost or political cost from the United States or many other international actors. And so we've seen this backsliding. And I think by talking about it and then following that up, it will make a difference. And, you know, it puts these countries on notice. And so if Sisi is reacting even to this creation of the Democracy Caucus by a few members of Congress, then, you know, that's very telling about how impactful these signals can be. But the U.S.-Egypt relationship is very complex because there's just so much synergy at a societal level. You know, a lot of Egyptians are following what's happening in the United States. There's a lot of ties in the United States to Egypt. And so no leader in Egypt can ignore the United States. And too often, U.S. leaders have simply focused on the security dimensions and ignored all the other aspects without realizing that, you know, a more democratic and a better governed Egypt that's adhering to the rule of law is going to be more stable and going to be more active in dealing with all the developmental challenges that Egypt has. So, you know, the two aren't exclusive. In fact, they often go together.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Guinea worm, a waterborne parasite that 35 years ago infected an estimated 3.5 million people in nearly two dozen countries, mostly in Africa, has been nearly eradicated. This is thanks to cheap water filtration products, national planning and grassroots education efforts, hardcore science, and the work of aid groups like the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Last year, only 27 people in six countries experienced the excruciating effects of Guinea worm, which takes a year to incubate in the human body after a person has ingested its larvae in drinking water. For the second part of our two-part series, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Adam Weiss, director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program. He began by outlining a few simple time-tested ways to avoid infection.
There's a number of very low-cost, low-tech solutions to help assist with stopping transmission. For example, both the straw filter or pipe filter and cloth filters that households and individuals can use to protect themselves from guinea worm that might be in the water that they're drinking, as well as having constant access to information from the volunteers about what's going on in their community or in neighboring communities so that they can take the necessary measures.
What is the basic life cycle of the guinea worm?
Somebody has guinea worm and they enter into a stagnant water body. The worm releases tens of thousands of larvae, and then there's a small little organism called a copepod that picks up the larva, and then after a few weeks, that larva is now infectious, and if you drink that water, 1 year later, you will have guinea worm.
With a one-year lag time like that, it can be far from intuitive to somebody just how they got infected.
And so I have heard from people that it's juju or magic. It was a curse put on my family. That's why every year we have guinea worm. The science tells us differently. But how do you approach that person or that family if you can have discussions with them about even applying their own religious beliefs? For example, in many Muslim areas, the quality of your water is important in terms of performing certain religious activities. And so really helping them see it through their own systems and structures becomes very powerful, even if they've never had guinea worm themselves.
This idea of listening and taking the cue from the community itself is part and parcel of the Carter Center's holistic approach, which is still fairly unconventional.
I think that's the key. Guinea worm eradication program is not as simple as just a top-down approach where you have presidents, decrees, or policies that are going to help stop guinea worm transmission. You have to have a bottom-up approach that is owned and operated by the communities and the individuals of those communities. Then you also need all the other stakeholders that are part of supply chain processes, funding, helping with science, and refining our own ability to target interventions, understand Mother Nature and ecology and the different dynamics that go into transmission.
The Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program has been around since 1986 and has achieved almost total success. How do you still get people to make guinea worm eradication a real priority? Isn't it kind of out of sight, out of mind?
A lot of people know about guinea worm from firsthand experience in West Africa, particularly in Nigeria and in Ghana. Nigeria, when they first were starting to target guinea worm, there were more than 500,000 cases a year there. In Ghana, several hundred thousand cases a year. And having reduced infections from 3.5 million down to only 27 humans left in the world, the program, to a certain extent, becomes a victim of its own success. Younger generations didn't have that first firsthand experience, but certainly there's been a lot of communication and dissemination of information about guinea worm through different awareness creation campaigns and cash reward systems to try and motivate people to come forward. So you kind of have the two pieces of it where you don't have a lot of people suffering with it right now. And so you don't have that kind of strong, this is impacting millions of people's lives today. But there still is an appreciation that this is a disease nobody wanted 30 years ago and nobody wants today. And I think in part what has made the guinea worm program so successful is that it's not about saying, here are the three interventions, just do this and everything will be fine, but helping people understand those interventions, helping them understand the transmission cycle, even if they didn't go to school, even if they don't know the scientific methods, that they can learn to appreciate what water looks like when I don't filter it, and what does it look like if I do filter it, and then what impacts me down the road from there.
You sound quite hopeful.
The end is well within reach, and we're going to continue to help cross the finish line.
Adam Weiss is director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program in Atlanta, Georgia. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The International Criminal Court today convicted Dominique Ongwen, a commander of the Ugandan rebel group Lord's Resistance Army, of 61 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The LRA abducted Ongwen as a young boy and forced him to be a child soldier. But judges at the court said the adult Ongwen acted out of free will and committing innumerable crimes between 2002 and 2005, commanding several hundred soldiers. They included murder, torture, attacks on internally displaced people camps, rape, forced pregnancy, and constricting children under age 15 into the LRA. Ongwen, wearing a tie and face mask, sat impassively in court, sometimes with his eyes closed, listening to the judgment that was read out. A hearing in mid-April will consider a possible sentence, which could be up to life imprisonment, with a decision expected later this year. Observers say France is considering downsizing its military presence as the security situation stabilizes in Africa's Sahel region. French troops and African nations have been fighting together against extremist groups there. As Nicolas Pinot reports for VOA from Paris, the size of that force is likely to drastically change.
In his annual New Year's wishes to the military a few weeks ago, President Emmanuel Macron made it clear that France could adjust its forces in the Sahel, meaning a reduction in the size of the so-called Barkhane force. French soldiers have been fighting extremist groups for years along with soldiers from Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania and Chad. In 2020, the former colonial power boosted its troop presence by 600, bringing the toll to 5,100 soldiers to counter extremists. After major successes with the killing of top jihadist commanders, France wants to withdraw the 600 temporary reinforcements and return the number of troops remaining to 4,500. General Dominique Trinquant is former head of the French military mission with the United Nations.
Je pense qu'effectivement la réduction sur le court terme, en tout cas, ce sera probablement...
Trinquant said the additional 600 French troops that were deployed a year ago would probably return to France, as they completed their mission to degrade the enemy and its capacities in the three-border zone. He thinks the move should not have a negative impact on the ground. However, Trinquant is concerned about the ability for the African troops and the European reinforcements to compensate for the departure. Concern is growing among the public, as a recent opinion poll showed for the first time that the majority of French people oppose the operation in the Sahel. More than 50 French soldiers have been killed since 2013 while fighting extremists in the region. And the threat has expanded tremendously beyond Mali. Bernard Rémier is the Director General of France's External Intelligence Service. The official made a rare public appearance this week and commented openly on the current security situation in West Africa. He warned on the extremist ability to expand their network to other countries in the region.
La plupart des commandants ne sont pas maliens, ce sont des étrangers. Et pour desserrer l'étau dans lequel ils sont pris...
Amy explained that most current jihadist leaders in the Sahel are not Malian, but foreigners, who are already expanding their network by financing men in Ivory Coast or Benin. Emi said that fighters are already operating and killing in Nigeria, Niger or Chad on behalf of the terrorist group Boko Haram. A summit among France and the G5 Sahel countries is scheduled for February 15 and 16 in N'Djamena, Chad. Due to the pandemic, some head of states might join the meeting by video conference. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
The World Trade Organization is meeting today to discuss a proposal by South Africa and India to waive monopolies on COVID-19 medical tools. Amid opposition to the measures by some countries' international humanitarian organization, Doctors Without Borders, known by their French name, Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is calling for a more equitable distribution of the life-saving vaccines to poorer nations. It says, if adopted, the proposal has the potential to ensure billions of people worldwide have access to COVID-19 medicines, vaccines, and diagnostics, since it would allow more manufacturers to make these products. For more, International Edition's Chinudu Afor spoke with Yuan Kyung-hu, policy coordinator at MSF's Access Campaign.
Our concern is, after a few months of discussion, in our opinion, from our experiences, the obvious public health benefits the proposal can bring into the current situation of COVID, when many countries are struggling to counter the IP and technology controlled by the pharmaceutical company. Despite all of this public health benefit are obvious reasons that every country should support, we see the kind of delay in reaching any common ground because of a small group of countries want to talk about something else, notably US, UK, EU, Australia, Canada, Norway, and Japan and Brazil.
Are you implying that some of these wealthier countries might monopolize COVID-19 or the processes of manufacturing COVID-19 to the detriment of poorer nations, especially in Africa and Asia?
That is our impression, because the ironic situation now is that, for instance, we know European Union had some problem with supply of vaccines since last week. They themselves actually are lacking legal mechanism to effectively tackle the monopoly held by the companies. But at the same time, they also don't want to give up their own monopoly in terms of, because many of these wealthy countries already hold it and monopolize a lot of vaccines and other things. They are blocking the opportunity for the others, like developing country, poorer country, low and middle country, to find a way to help themselves.
Do you think your call for this particular mechanism would work, bearing in mind that those countries who you are hoping will turn down this waiver are the same ones who are in charge of either manufacturing or distributing the COVID-19 vaccine?
I would say this situation is a little bit complex, because for the moment, we don't even think they are in charge in a sense. I mean, they have provided a lot of financial support to the mechanism such as COVAX and the WHO coordinated process, aiming to provide some equitable distribution allocation of vaccine. However, it doesn't mean they can actually decide where the production would happen and how supply need to be equitably allocated, because of two reasons. First, looking at what happened in EU is very telling. The Commission and the government, they need to ask the companies to permit them to act and to move around the supply issues.
Is the MSF further calling for some of these countries to put pressure on some of these companies manufacturing this COVID-19 vaccine?
We definitely are calling for more diversified manufacture and supply, because now we see those companies, right? So I said they are doing partnership and so on, but it is very selective. They only choose a few that they like. And also, it is very uncertain to see what kind of deal and what kind of terms they actually signed.
That's Yuan Kyung-hu, policy coordinator for Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign. She spoke with my colleague Chinedu Afor from Geneva. Calling themselves Chefs with Compassion, a group of cooks are donating their skills to feed thousands of South Africans left hungry as a result of COVID-19 and salvaging food that would otherwise be thrown away. More than 10 million tons of food go to waste every year in the country, yet more than 16 million people go hungry each day. In Johannesburg, Tuso Kumalo visited the chefs to see how they gather their menu items and convert them into delicious meals.
It's 6 o'clock in the morning and a team of dedicated chefs, hotel catering students and humanitarian work volunteers are already hard at work at the Chefs with Compassion, CWC's food rescue sharehouse in Johannesburg. Every day, tons of waste produce rescued from the local fresh produce market join donations from hotels, restaurants and supermarkets of food that's likely not to be used before its expiry date. Yeshna Maharaj, a qualified chef, is coordinating the food assistance program.
We decided there was a lot of fruit and vegetables that were sitting in the market and that were going to no use and was being disposed of. And we then came up with the idea of let's go out and rescue this produce and let's get around to our kitchens, our hotels, our restaurants, and let's see how many people we could reach.
For close to a year, Austin Numalo, also a chef, has volunteered by washing and sorting the rescued food.
Usually when something comes here, it is not appealing to the eye. So when you have it in your hand, you wouldn't buy it yourself at the shop. But then after we sort it out, you buy it at the shop. Like, for example, if you look at these tomatoes, like some of them are good and then some of them are bad. So we sort them out in such a way that you can eat them as well.
Nishan Kishore is the founder of the Infinity Foundation, one of the 32 organizations that collect the rescued food from Chefs with Compassion.
The veg that can't be used to cook as solids, we make soups with them. Then we also make biryanis with them because we use staples as rice and stuff, and we can make a solid meal with protein for elderly and kids. And then thirdly, we also give them as food parcels. So families still have food when we're no longer there. So that's what makes up us feeding about 15,000 people a week.
The prepared meals are then taken to the homes of the needy children, the elderly and families. Sebishwe Jumas Malaika Orphanage in Hillbro, Johannesburg is one of the beneficiaries.
Any help which comes in here is really cherished so much. We appreciate all the donation that comes in. When they come in with the donation, when they come in with the soup, when they come in with the foodstuffs, yes, it helps us a lot to make sure that at least our children have something to eat. And yes, they become happy.
The initiative has produced over 1.3 million meals since South Africa declared its first COVID-19-related lockdown last March. Nearly 100 volunteers are now part of the program. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Botswana has run out of COVID-19 test kits, forcing the Southern African country to halt polymerase chain reaction PCR testing. Rapid tests will be prioritized in the meantime, with health authorities admitting it might take weeks to get new test kits. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's head of National Health Laboratory, Dr. Madisa Main, says the country is facing an acute shortage of robotic tips used in COVID-19 testing. He says, as a result, health authorities have decided to halt PCR testing. The few available kits are now reserved for VIP testing and cases of extreme emergency, Main said. Botswana is experiencing rising COVID-19 numbers, which now stand at 21,293. The daily average shot up from around 150 in December to more than 300 in January. A highly transmissible variant detected in South Africa, and festive season activities were blamed for the rise. Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, says the solution lies in vaccinating the entire population. The country has approached the World Bank for a loan to purchase their vaccines.
The real long-term solution is to vaccinate. Now, these other intervening measures are coping mechanisms, and they're very costly. They draw out blood for long. We want to procure the most efficacious vaccine given our circumstances and vaccinate the whole population.
Botswana says it does not expect new test kits anytime soon, citing global demand for COVID-19 accessories. For VOA, this is Mokgweetsi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf behalf of our producer, Mokibili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.